I'm Erin Allen, this is Curious City. And today our producer, Justin Bull, is in downtown Chicago with our question asker, Jeanette Say.
Hi, Jeanette. I'm Justin, how's it going?
They're at the Merchandise Mart Hall of Fame, which is a row of 8 bronze heads of famous Chicago businessmen.
Oh, great.
They're standing in front of one that depicts Aaron Montgomery Ward.
How would you describe this monument here?
I would describe it as a Pez head, because that's what it looks like to me.
Now, you might be familiar with Ward. He's the catalog guy who revolutionized the idea of mail order shopping 150 years ago. It wasn't until after Ward's death that his company turned into the department store, you might remember, as well.
Things are
You would expect this bust of Ward in front of Merchandise Mart, but his real claim to fame, according to Jeanette, is Grant Park.
Well, of course, everybody knows him as a retailer, and what I don't think most people know is that he spent 20 years to preserve the lakefront for everybody to enjoy.
She's right. If not for Ward, the Grant Park you know well would look very different, because it would have a lot more buildings in it. Jeanette thinks that more people should know about that.
I just think it's kind of an injustice, and he kind of hinted that he wasn't going to be appreciated for it. You know, he suggested that, I don't think I'll be remembered for this. So it's kind of fulfilling prophecy.
That led Jeanette to ask us this.
My question is, why isn't Montgomery Ward's name more prominently featured along the lakefront? Because that's his legacy.
So today, we're going to look at what Ward did and why he did it, at significant personal cost. And we'll ask why, relative to his contributions, there is so little love for Ward on the lakefront, a place he fought relentlessly to keep, quote, forever open, clear, and free. Justin is going to take it from here after the break.
There isn't like one department or one authority to ask why Ward's name isn't featured more in Chicago. So to answer our listener question, we've got to look back at who Ward is and what he did. And before he became watchdog of the lakefront, Aaron Montgomery Ward was quite the tycoon. I'm looking at an old Montgomery Ward catalog from 1875. And move over Jeff Bezos, because inside are bedsheets, mosquito nets, window curtains, menswear, womenswear, boots, watches, jewelry, spring beds, suitcases, farm wagons, buggies, beds, booze, and of course, buyer testimonials.
It was just about everything that you could possibly want.
That's the voice of Roberta Allen, the author of a forthcoming biography of Ward. She tells me that before Ward, you could have ordered a few specific items through the mail. But his company made thousands of products available to rural Americans using a hot new tech, the railroad.
He was basically responsible for the development of the mail order industry. All of the retailers who are in mail order and internet business should be terribly thankful to that man.
It's on page 2 of this Ward catalog where you find a key phrase in big letters. We guarantee all of our goods. Ward promised satisfaction or your money back, all expenses paid by him. For the time, this was radical and necessary to build trust with his customers. And Ward's business model worked very well. It was later emulated and scaled up significantly by Sears, Roebuck, and Rosenwald, and it made Ward one of the wealthiest men in America. But before all that, Roberta says Ward came from humble beginnings. He was born outside New York City in Chatham, New Jersey, the oldest of 7. His father was a shoemaker when shoemaking was getting mechanized, so Ward had to work.
He was not born to means at all, but he was a person who had ambition. I don't think his father had ambition, nor did his brother. I don't know if it has something to do with being the firstborn. But he was determined to get out and make something of himself.
The family moved to Southwest Michigan, and Ward went on to manage a general store in St. Joseph, then to work for Marshall Field in Chicago for several years, then to work as a traveling salesman and a dry goods merchant in St. Louis. All the while, he was getting ideas and squirreling away money.
He had about $1,600, I think, and had bought some items and stuff that he was thinking of selling. And then the Chicago Fire took place and destroyed it all. And he started back from scratch. And then the rest is history, as it were.
By 1887, Ward's company is thriving. And this is when Ward buys a plot of land on the west side of Michigan Avenue, across from Grant Park, which at the time was called Lake Park. He builds the Montgomery Ward Tower Building. And here begins his quest to thwart all manner of development projects along the lakefront.
He looks out the window of his office and he sees railroad cars. The Illinois Central Railroad was busy building scaffolding to load junk, you know, like garbage.
This is prominent legal scholar Tom Merrill, co-author of the book Lakefront, Public Trust and Private Rights in Chicago.
And he's outraged by this. You know, he doesn't want to look out his window and see garbage. So he asks his attorney to file a lawsuit or do something to get rid of this garbage collection process. And so that was the first Ward case that was filed.
Ward's argument went a little something like this, and bear with me, because there's a bit of minutia. Ward owned a lot on Michigan Avenue. Back when that lot and all the others next to it were first plotted out, a state commission was created to sell those lots using commercially made maps. And on those maps was a note next to that big lakefront park. Actually, it was more of a promise. It said that the park was to remain, quote, forever open, clear, and free of any buildings or other obstructions, whatever, end quote.
This was thought to be a kind of dedication of this Lake Park area, that it would never have any buildings. And so people that were interested in buying a lot on Michigan Avenue had this promise based on these maps that were used in selling the lots. So they went for higher prices.
So someone wants to put a building or an obstruction or a whatever on Ward's neighborhood park? Well, that would devalue property for which Ward paid top dollar.
The courts back in the 19th century were quite willing to issue injunctions against anybody that violated one of these so-called dedications.
And injunctions Ward sought, an absolute onslaught of them. He put the kibosh on a circus tent, a bicycle track, an armory, and he was just getting started. Here's Roberta.
Ward, at one time or another, was confronting the federal government, the Illinois legislature, the city council, the South Park commissioners, the Field Museum, Illinois Central, the Olympic Committee, directors of the Carrar Library. He had a lot of people who were not very happy with him.
Ward was a serial litigant. People don't typically like serial litigants. Hold on to that thought. What happens that makes Ward the key figure here and not some other Michigan Avenue landowner?
He was tenacious. He won this first case in the trial court. And then he got very, I think the word we use in the book is imperious. All the rest of the property owners that owned hotels on Michigan Avenue or whatever, they would sue, but they would usually drop out. You know, it costs money to file a lawsuit. Ward had the deep pockets, and he had this passion, whatever its motivations were, to preserve Grant Park. You know, he had to give his consent to anything that happened in Grant Park in the way of a structure or a building.
Sometimes Ward won, sometimes Ward lost. But his various lawsuits and injunctions went up to the Illinois Supreme Court exactly four times. And of those, he won. Hold on, checking my notes. Oh, yes, that's right. All of them. The decision in Ward number one was unanimous. It upheld that idea that the words on those maps from the 1830s were legally binding. Grant Park must remain forever open, clear, and free. The Ward 2 case was decided a few years later, as the city was making Grant Park bigger and bigger by literally filling Lake Michigan with sand and dirt. Surely this new parkland cannot be subject to the same onerous restrictions as Ward number one, right? Wrong. Ward won that one unanimously as well. Buildings could only go up in Grant Park, no matter how big the city made it, if adjacent property owners gave their consent. And Ward frequently did not give his consent. But sometimes he did. For example, the Art Institute, famously within Grant Park, right? When construction began, Ward issued no protest. And in 1896, Ward gave his consent for a temporary post office, an ungainly building, Merrill wrote, right across the street from Ward's. Now, this decision is easier to read as self-serving. Merrill notes that at this exact time, Ward's company had become the single largest customer of the United States Postal Service. It was around this time that Daniel Burnham and Edward Bennett were developing their dazzling, utopian plan of Chicago, which included an expanded lakefront park with a library and a natural history museum as its centerpiece. There was a burst of civic energy associated with the 1893 World's Fair, Merrill wrote, and a group called the South Park Commissioners unleashed a flurry of plans to fill Grant Park with additional land and with permanent monumental structures. And Ward, he was like, nah.
They got very hostile. They were all part of the big money elite, so you know everyone was used to getting their own way. And the South Park Commissioners were very frustrated by Ward. And the newspapers were very critical of Ward at this point in time. They said, you know, why is he standing in the way of having these wonderful structures put in Grant Park where the people can truly easily enjoy them? What's this guy's problem, you know? So he was getting very bad press during these periods.
Ward's lawsuits essentially kept Grant Park a big empty field for many, many years. And the bad press did not hinder him. In fact, here comes Ward cases 3 and 4, even nastier fights involving yet another major Chicago luminary. Marshall Field was Ward's former employer, if you remember. He dies in 1906. And in his will, Field leaves $8 million to the city of Chicago for the building of a grand natural history museum with his name on it.
Field is a fascinating figure in that, yeah, he's does this philanthropic work, but there's always a catch.
Paul DeRica is the director of exhibitions at the Chicago History Museum.
It's classic Marshall Field. So when Field dies, he basically says that the city has 6 years after his death to provide land upon which this new museum can be built.
The ticking clock.
Right.
And if the city cannot decide on a spot for the Field Museum, that $8 million reverts back to Field's estate. Was Ward worried that litigation might prevent the city from such a generous windfall? Was Ward scared of Field's ghost? He was not. He filed suit. But Ward did give the South Park Commissioners a settlement offer, a truce, really. He said, hey, you know what? You can build the Field Museum right in the middle of Grant Park, as long as you stop there. No more buildings after that one.
But they wouldn't agree to that. They had this vision of Grant Park being filled with lots of, you know, neoclassical monumental buildings, and they didn't want Ward messing up their vision.
He did mess it up. This case, Ward 3, also went to the Illinois Supreme Court, who again ruled in favor of Ward. Ward 4 was the last attempt by the South Park Commissioners, who thought they finally had a trump card, eminent domain. The bedrock legal move that lets the government seize land with just compensation. Ward probably should have lost this one, Merrill says, but a divided court seemingly didn't want to upend its own precedents, 20 years of them.
Okay.
Bottom line, Ward wins again.
All right, we're just going to walk.
No Field Museum in Grant Park.
Just going to go for a little walk over to the place where the Field Museum would have been. Had old Aaron Montgomery Ward not meddled his little nose in it. Okay, I'm here. I'm at the proposed site of the Field Museum. And spoiler alert, it is Buckingham Fountain.
Why did Montgomery Ward go through all of this trouble?
Oh, they got new chairs here.
That's after the break.
Take a seat.
I went for a walk through Grant Park on a hot morning.
And there's kids playing soccer. There's some jungle ball being played, softball, skateboarders. And you know what there isn't? Tall buildings. There are cars. There's a road going right through the middle of Grant Park. But there are no tall buildings.
How decisive was Ward's impact on how Grant Park looks?
Huge. Absolutely huge.
Because of Ward, the Field Museum is down by Northerly Island. The Carrar Library is over in Hyde Park. An unknown number of other constructions were never even attempted. So why are his contributions not emblazoned on every corner? Merrill says, for one, he was extremely private.
Unlike many millionaires and billionaires today, he did not try to toot his own horn or promote himself in any way whatsoever.
Paul DeRica agrees.
I think Ward isn't as well known today as you think he would be or should be, simply because he went out of his way not to be within the public eye beyond his business.
Ward wrote no memoirs. He declined offers to have write-ups about him in little books about important Chicagoans. And when I said earlier that Roberta Allen was writing his biography, I didn't mention that hers will be the first full-length biography of Ward. At least, that's not a children's book.
Actually, I should tell you, when I started out, I had no idea that there was no biography already done of Montgomery Ward. It was a big surprise to me.
So, extreme privacy is one reason. Another, Roberta says memories of Ward often get swallowed up by the company that bears his name. A company Ward took a step back from way back in 1903. A company that got real bad press for fighting with FDR during World War II. And a company that struggled mightily before liquidating in 2001.
And the other thing was he left no direct heirs.
Ward had an adopted daughter, Marjorie, who did not become part of the company. When Ward died in 1913, the business went to his nephews. So did Ward not want his name everywhere? Maybe. Paul DeRica offers an interesting parallel in Julius Rosenwald, the man who helped Sears become a business Goliath.
You know, Rosenwald is the person more or less responsible for the Museum of Science and Industry today. I mean, he is, right? But he was clear, kind of like Ward, that he didn't want his name attached to it because he thought that it should serve this kind of like broader good and kind of common good. And so you want to like respect that, right?
Field got his museum. George Pullman got a whole neighborhood. And you can point to any number of other folks who put their names on stuff. Ward, apart from his business, just did not seem to want that. Here's Tom Merrill.
The company biographies say that he gave a lot of money to charity, even at the end of his life, but he always made anonymous donations. So that's sort of consistent with not having these biographies written up and so forth. So maybe he would be okay with the fact that Grant Park is preserved, but Montgomery Ward is kind of forgotten. I don't know.
But Ward is not completely forgotten. He does have a lasting legacy.
I would say if we have a saint, it's probably Montgomery Ward.
That's Fred Bates, a longtime board member at Friends of the Parks. Fred sees something sacred in Ward and in that key phrase that he's associated with.
Forever open, clear, and free is kind of a more than a mantra. It's almost a biblical way of saying this is so important to our city and its health that any intrusion on that concept is troubling.
Fred says Friends of the Parks cites Ward a lot because Ward is often appropriate in one way or another. And when you think about fights over who gets to build what on public land, top of mind might be the Obama Presidential Center setting up shop in Jackson Park. Or you might remember the lawsuits over George Lucas wanting to put his museum near Soldier Field. That museum also opens this year in Los Angeles. But in those fights and some others, Fred says the Ward cases were not cited legally as much as they were spiritually. That's because the Ward decisions only apply to the actual geographic parameters of Grant Park. And remember that promise written on those maps? Well, the Illinois Supreme Court issued a separate ruling in 1970 that gave those kinds of promises fewer teeth elsewhere.
So if you live in some town in Illinois like Joliet or Peoria or something, and there's some like park in the middle of the town that was on some original plat that says, you know, forever free of buildings as a park or forever to be used as a park, you can't use this common law dedication right if the city wants to put up condominiums. According to the Illinois Supreme Court in 1970, I mean, they might change their mind, but who knows?
So what were Ward's motives? Tom contemplates several theories in his writings, that maybe Ward was an environmentalist ahead of his time. He also suggests that Ward was driven by money, the desire to increase the market value of properties on Michigan Avenue. For nearly any of Ward's fights that suggest one motive, you might find another that muddies things up. Sometimes he opposed small structures, sometimes large ones, sometimes temporary ones. Perhaps he was a populist. Perhaps he was just competitive.
You know, this happens to people sometimes that get involved in these long-time litigational fights, you know, married couples that can't agree on custody or something like that. He achieved great success initially, and he kind of got into it, and I think, you know, sort of he got the taste of blood in his mouth or whatever for fighting these cases in court because he was winning so much, and so he just kept doing it, you know. I don't know, maybe that's overly simplistic or something, but for whatever reasons, in current value terms, he spent over $1 million in legal fees fighting these cases.
Unfortunately, because Ward was so private, we largely don't know what he was thinking.
All we have to go off of is that single interview that he gives in October of 1909.
That's Paul DeRica again. Ward did give one interview to the Chicago Tribune after winning Ward number 3.
And in it, he basically says that he is more or less like standing up for the little guy, for the people of Chicago. He wants them to have this green space.
The interview gives the idea that Ward knew he was not well-liked. Quote, "Had I known in 1890 how long it would take me to preserve a park for the people against their will, I doubt if I would have undertaken it," Ward said. Quote, "I think there is not another man in Chicago who would have spent the money I have spent in this fight with the certainty that even gratitude would be denied as interest."
He said, "I fought for the poor people of Chicago, not for the millionaires. Here is a park frontage on the lake comparing favorably with the Bay of Naples, which city officials would crowd with buildings, transforming the breathing spot for the poor with a showground of the educated rich. I do not think it is right, and the highest court in the state has thrice upheld me." That's a pretty powerful statement.
And this is perhaps the closest we can get to answering our listener question. The biggest reason you don't see more of Ward's name in Chicago. He fought the rich and powerful for over 20 years. Ward, to be sure, was rich and powerful too, but the people he was up against, those were the ones who put up monuments and put up names on institutions. And Ward was just not the type to do that for himself. Roberta told me that she did set off to write Ward's biography because she admired the man, but she still approached him with skepticism. Now, after digging into his past for many years, she takes him at his word.
"I do not think that you do a fight for 22 years if you do not have a vision of what you want to leave." And he wanted that park to be for the people, not just then, but he talks about he wants it to be forever. He, in the end, did not disappoint me. He did not disappoint me as a person. I think he was real.
Now, some listeners might be shaking their fist at me because Ward's name is on a number of things in Chicago. One of them is a park on the Chicago River, named for Ward in 2010, with support from Friends of the Parks. Another is a key Northwestern Medicine School building, so named after Ward's widow donated $8 million to the university. And of course, how could I forget the Montgomery Ward Memorial Gardens? That is a section of Grant Park by 11th Street and Michigan Avenue, dedicated in 1993. I went and checked it out.
All right, I'm walking up. It's pretty small, these Aaron Montgomery Ward Gardens. There's a little bust, some flowers, some shrubs, and a little plaque. Would he have wanted more? Yeah, I can't say. He's dead.
The gardens are easy to pass by. It's no Garfield Park Conservatory. But hey, it's a monument to Ward. I mentioned all these tributes to our question asker, Jeanette.
Is that not enough?
It's not enough because it's not on the lakefront. That's my feeling. If, you know, the gardens are a mile from the lakefront, I would like to see something on the lakefront so that people could see it. I think the Montgomery Ward Lakefront Trail has a nice ring to it.
Nice. Yeah, for sure.
The Park District told me it has no current plans for any more Ward fanfare. But it sure seems that's the way Ward would have wanted it.
This week's Curiosity was reported by our producer, Justin Bull. Susie Ahn is our editor. Curiosity is a production of WBEZ Chicago and is a part of the NPR network. If you have questions about Chicago and the region, send them our way at curiosity@wbez.org, or you can visit us at wbez.org/curiosity. I'm your host, Erin Allen. Thank you for listening. I'll talk to you next week.